Today on the Root Cause Medicine Podcast.
Most of them are either directly or indirectly related to weight gain. And this was interesting too. And I'm extremely sensitive when it comes to weight gain because for many of my late teens, early adult years, I had disordered eating and I try to be really compassionate and very sensitive around this topic because what we don't want to do is to go into diet culture and having to look at everything and take track every single thing, right? Every macro, every calorie, that's not what I want to do. But the important thing to understand is that another common thing that I see on my social media is, how come we're not talking about the weight gain? Please talk more about the weight gain. And it's an important thing to talk about and to mention just because as we go into perimenopause and menopause, we're more susceptible to things like heart disease. It's an important thing. I want to bring it up because I want to validate women who are experiencing it.
Hello, hello. I'm your co-host for today, Dr. Carrie Jones. And I am so excited to have menopause educator Andrea Donsky-Ellen to talk about all things perimenopause and menopause. Andrea is an author, a nutritionist, an entrepreneur, a podcast host, a media personality. She does all the things. She's also the co-founder of Morphus, a menopause educational platform that also conducts survey research for women in both perimenopause and menopause. And that's what we talk about today. We break down her research bit by bit. What are the top 10 symptoms? How do they relate to the brain? What's going on in the body? What's going on with sleep? We cover it all. And she even gives her top tips as a nutritionist to help you through this transitional period. So if you or someone you know is perimenopausal or menopausal, this is the episode for you. This will help answer a lot of questions and even give you insight on how you can make this transition much more seamless. Before we get started though, I want to talk to you about something that comes up pretty often on this podcast, and that, of course, are supplements. There is a lot of confusion around supplements, and you only want to take the best quality that uses top-tier certified manufacturers, and most importantly, do third-party independent testing to make sure what's on the label is in the capsule. That's why I've teamed up with New Ethics Formulations as their chief medical officer. The team already had a strong history in the supplement world, but started the company to really focus on bettering your health and helping to enhance your physique or performance goals. I'm excited to help them continue to focus on the endocrine system and hormones as it relates to glucose, thyroid, estrogen, and even your gut microbiome. Right now, you can get 20% off one order using code DrJones20 at newethics.com. That's DrJones20 at newethics.com today. Now, let's get on with the show. Oh my goodness, Andrea, welcome to the Root Cause Medicine Podcast. I cannot wait to talk to you today all about perimenopause and menopause because that is such a transition for a lot of people.
It is. Thank you so much for having me. I am excited to be here.
Well, first, before we really jump into the science and the research that you have and your approach, how did you get into this in the first place?
Personal experience.
Yeah.
I'm like, isn't that how we all get here? Mm-hmm. Seriously. What's interesting is that I was in perimenopause. Now, looking back and all the work that I've been doing now for the last 6-7 years in the menopause space is at 36, I started with phantom smells, but I didn't know that until years later, literally in the last couple of years. I had had all these issues. I had my third baby at 41. And then at 42, all of these symptoms came. They actually never went away after I was postpartum. And I was like, wait a minute, it should be going away now. What's happening? And then I started realizing that maybe something is off, but I wasn't sure. And I would ask so many people, Carrie, I'd be like, hey, are you experiencing this crazy weight gain or your boobs are really huge? Because my boobs got really huge. And, or do you find your sleep is off? Or how about the up and down of the weight fluctuations? And people are like, no, no, no. And I'm like, wait, is it me? Am I going crazy? What is going on? And then at 47, I got my first hot flash. And that's when I said, wait. Maybe everything I'm experiencing is actually because I'm in menopause. I didn't even know the word perimenopause existed. And that's what started me down my rabbit hole of research and really trying to understand this phase of life. So now I know I was in perimenopause for 14 years, 9 of which I had no idea.
And I think that resonates with a lot of people. And actually, the first thing I want to talk about is your research with your company, Morphus, because a lot of people, when they responded, didn't know either or were checking the boxes for symptoms. Phantom smells, itchy ears. That hot flashes and night sweats are very common, but you're probably the first person I saw on social media to say there's over 100 symptoms. in perimenopause. When you look online, some people will say 20, some people will say 32. And I want you to really break this down for us.
And it's such a good point, because when I started my research years ago, when I just started getting into it, I had met a friend at a party and she had said that she was creating an app for perimenopause and menopause. And I was like, really, you're creating an app? Are there that many symptoms? She's like, yeah, there's like 35, 40 symptoms. I'm like, wow, that sounds like a lot. And the way my brain works, Carrie, I am so analytical. I literally went home and I started a Google Doc and I was like, okay, what are all these symptoms? It was intriguing to me. So I'm starting to write down all the symptoms, but then quickly I started realizing there are way more than 34. And if you look online, like you're saying, they'll say there's 34 recognized symptoms of perimenopause and menopause. As we started doing our research, and now so many years later, we say now there's 103 plus, we just added another one, 104. There are over 100 symptoms of perimenopause and menopause, and many of them that we don't really pay attention to or may not realize it, the lesser known, like you were saying, itchy ears. I have a video that went viral this week on phantom smells. Phantom smells, I now realize I started at 36, was my very first symptom of perimenopause, but I had several MRIs, several tests, several visits to the doctor. Thank goodness. Obviously, we always want to rule everything out before we say, yep, it's a symptom of perimenopause or menopause. But it was something like, wait a minute, you're telling me that the smoke or the BO or the mildew or the rotten eggs, all of these that we're smelling can actually, could be a symptom? And it's like, yeah, could be a symptom. So it's validating in the sense that we put a number to it, because a lot of women are told that it's just deal with it, it's part of life, or who cares what the symptoms are? If you know you're in this stage, or maybe you don't and you're learning. But I like to validate women and support women. And that is very important to me as we're going through this phase of life, that what you're feeling, you're not crazy. I have to say, probably the comments I see the most on my page is, am I going crazy? How come nobody's understanding me? Like, these are things. So I'm like, nope, we're here to tell you, you are not, and we're validating you. And of course, always get things checked out to confirm 100%.
Well, and again, reading the white paper that you published and the surveys that you did, again, I want to talk about that, because for me, just to read it, I agree with you. I felt like I had a lot of comments from practitioners and patients alike who said, I don't know if this is a symptom. I don't really know what's going on. I have been told, well, welcome to the change. Good luck. And no real guidance from there. When you did that survey, what were the big aha for you and what was really surprising?
I would say that 53% of women aren't getting the help that they're looking for. I thought that was extremely surprising. And what we found is that 20% of women don't know what stage they're in. So let's start there. And that was interesting to me. I was one of the 20%. And right now, and you're saying we have two published white papers. One is on the signs and symptoms. So we're big on the symptomatology. And the other one is on sleep. My next goal is to get to 5,000 for each. Right now we have 3,000 for each of the responses, which is incredible. We have an incredible community. 20% we now know, based on the 3,000 responses, don't know what stage they're in. They don't know if they're in menopause, in perimenopause, and or premenopause. And then the other thing that we found was interesting is that the top 10 symptoms, and I can tell you what they are. The number one symptom is fatigue. 72% of women in perimenopause and menopause experience fatigue. More so though, if you're in perimenopause. Women in perimenopause reported feeling fatigue more so than in menopause. That was interesting. The second one is brain fog. 66% of women experience brain fog. Sleep issues, huge. And that's something that is very well known. Many of us are experiencing it. And then we dug deeper in our second published white paper. Why are we not sleeping in perimenopause and menopause? And what we found, the top three reasons of a lack of sleep is, number one is waking up between 2 and 4 a.m. I know this is your jam, Carrie. Exactly. The cortisol rising at the wrong time. What is that number one reason? Stress. Anxiety. That's number one. Number two is bathroom visits. And number three is night sweats. Those are the top three reasons in why we're not sleeping. Then we have memory loss, anxiety, joint pain, lack of focus, lack of concentration, hot flashes, and low libido. I'm going to go actually the top 15 because I want to make a point here. Lack of patience, night sweats, slower metabolism, digestive problems, and then changes in body shape. To go back to your question, what was surprising, in the top 10, five of them were actually related to cognitive health. 50% of the symptoms that we're experiencing in this phase of life, 5 out of the 10 are related to cognitive health. That was extremely surprising to me.
And also very scary and very concerning, because I don't believe, other, maybe lately, especially with researchers like Dr. Lisa Mascani, who wrote the XX Brain and soon to be Menopause Brain, there has not been a lot of great research on the female brain, specifically in this transition. We have research on Alzheimer's as a whole. Traditionally, it's done on men, as you know. As women are getting into menopause, feeling like we're going crazy, losing our ability to multitask, ability to stay on track, ability to recall a word, can be really frightening and scary. We start to think, oh my gosh, am I developing dementia? But also it's helpful to know there's a lot we can do and don't just assume, well, I'm at that age. I guess this is how I live my life now, because we don't want this to continue. And the fact that you just said five are related to cognitive function, that's massive.
50% of the top 10. Yeah, huge, huge. And a huge eye-opener for me. And then the other thing we discovered is in the top 15, most of them are either directly or indirectly related to weight gain. And this was interesting too. And I'm extremely sensitive when it comes to weight gain, because for many of my late teens, early adult years, I had disordered eating, and I try to be really compassionate and very sensitive around this topic, because what we don't want to do is to go into diet culture and having to look at everything and take track every single thing, right? Every macro, every calorie, that's not what I want to do. But the important thing to understand is that another common thing that I see on my social media is, how come we're not talking about the weight gain? Please talk more about the weight gain. And it's an important thing to talk about and to mention, just because as we go into perimenopause and menopause, we're more susceptible to things like heart disease. It's an important thing. I want to bring it up because I want to validate women who are experiencing it. And just so to be clear too, is that more women from our research reported gaining weight in menopause than they did in perimenopause. Whereas in perimenopause, you'd see more of that weight fluctuation.
There's different types of fat tissue, adipose tissue. And a lot of the research, of course, now is being done on the visceral, the inflammatory, which we're going to talk about inflammation in here in just a bit. But that visceral fat and the shift it makes, we went from maybe in your younger years, depending, having more hips and a booty because of our estrogen impact. And then we make the shift. And what happens is we get that central obesity, central adiposity. And I also really appreciate that you said to validate it. I remember years ago, I believe it was the Mayo Clinic, said on average in menopause, a woman will gain 12 pounds. And I recorded that. And I said, what do you think, social media? What do you think? Most of the comments were like 12. Gosh, I wish 12. Like, I'm up in the 20s, the 30s, the 40s. My whole body shape has changed. Like, this is crazy. And I didn't change anything. And so when you and I were discussing what we were going to talk about before here, and a lot of it was around, again, glucose, insulin, inflammation, sleep, these factors that we're really going to get into, I thought, yes. Because not only does it play a role in our brain health, we know that the inflammatory cells in the fat tissue affect that, but it affects everything.
Everything. And it's a sensitive topic, but it's one that I think it's important to mention because, and like you said, when I was doing the research, I was like, I saw at the mean weight gain in menopause was 5 pounds. You saw 12, I saw 5. And there was like 3% of body fat. I'm like, what? I gained more like 15% of my body fat. So yes, you're absolutely right. In perimenopause, I had put on 20 pounds. And I've been in menopause, so I'm 54. I just turned 54 last week. And I have been in menopause now for, again, I think 4 years. I'm not 100% sure, coming back to all that research that we did, 4 or 5 years now. And last year I had a bout with Hashimoto's. When we talk about this, what are the things that impact or could impact weight gain? I had a bout with Hashimoto's, thyroid issues, and I had lost 20 pounds and then I had put back the 20 and then another 15. And which is interesting, right? Because we're going to talk about gut health, gut microbiome, like all of these impact our weight, right? But as much as putting on weight in this phase of life is very stressful for so many of us, like you said, 20 pounds, 30 pounds, 50 pounds, women have, we put on a lot of weight, even though we haven't done anything differently. We're exercising the same or we're eating the same. And that's an important thing to mention because what worked for us before we got here may not work for us anymore. And we really have to look at changing our habits, our lifestyle habits, our nutrition, our mindset. So many things need to be changed as we go into this phase of life in order to accommodate our changing bodies and changing everything that's going on.
And one of the big factors that does contribute to the weight gain is sleep, which of course is your second white paper that you published, because so many of us, myself included, in fact, at 4:30 in the morning, this morning, I was awake. And I woke up because I felt hot. And I was like, is this a hot flash? Or is it because it's minus 10 outside and my heat's kicked on? Regardless, it woke me up and then I couldn't fall back asleep. And that's not unusual. It's not unusual for me, myself, and I to wake up between 2 and 4 a.m., especially as I get close to my period. And I would imagine a lot of women can relate to that. In your sleep's white paper, again, what are some of the things that they told you? What did you find and what surprised you?
As I mentioned, I'll repeat it just in case. It's always good to repeat anyways. The number one reason we wake up is stress. Stress, anxiety, waking up between 2 and 4 a.m. Number two is bathroom visits. Number three is hot night sweats. But then there were other things like pain, inflammation, that they can't sleep. They're tossing and turning all night or having a hard time falling asleep, like insomnia. Or maybe there's too much noise in their room. Or maybe the light is keeping them up, which was interesting, actually. What I found was there was research that talked about having light in a room. And part of the sleep hygiene tips, and I talk a lot about how do we get that better night's sleep as we go into this phase of life. And one of the things is making sure your room is dark. And why is that important? Is because the research shows that even when we have moderate amount of light in the room, it can actually spike our insulin the next morning. It can increase our risk for type 2 diabetes. These are important factors that many of us may not think about. Keeping blackout blinds in your room or wearing a sleep mask, things like that are very important. I would say other things that came to mind were partners who snore, sleep apnea. These are all things that bed, perhaps their pillow is bothering them, or perhaps they haven't changed their mattress in a while, or they're too warm. These are all different reasons that people said that were that the things that were keeping them up in the middle of the night.
What's interesting is I was talking to the owner of a continuous glucose monitor company. We were discussing perimenopausal and menopausal women. And he said, there's a lot of great testing out there. We can check cortisol in the middle of the night. There's saliva tests or urine tests to do so. We know when we're stressed or anxious, we wake up mind racing, we're thinking about the next day, et cetera. But he said, you know what I'm starting to notice based on our data of continuous glucose wear is that subgroup of people who are perimenopausal and menopausal, their glucose, they become hypoglycemic in the middle of the night. They go down. And as a result, cortisol kicks in, or adrenaline, or both, to get the glucose back up. Instead, you wake feeling stressed or maybe feeling adrenaline or feeling cortisol because your blood sugar had fallen. And why had it fallen, which is your area of expertise, is like the nutrition aspect, but also the loss of hormone, estrogen, progesterone, and its role and how we do and don't process these foods like we used to.
Exactly. Muscle loss, that's a big thing in terms of why is our blood sugar fluctuating? And yes, obviously nutrition plays a huge role in it before going to sleep. When we eat, what time we eat, it makes a big difference too. We're less insulin sensitive at night. We're more insulin sensitive during the day. For some people, if you're more sensitive to carbohydrates like I am, I'm going to want to eat them during the day rather than before bed, which can mess with your blood sugar. The other thing is I hear from a lot of women too, is when they eat processed sugar or too much sugar before bed, that will really mess with their blood sugar. The way they explain it is it'll mess with their sleep. It could be messing with their blood sugar as well. Perhaps it's those peaks and those valleys. And that's a really interesting point about the CGM. I wore a CGM for a long time because I want to understand from an N of one. I do a lot of N of one testing and research. I know you do too.
Yes, yes.
It's our like passion.
Self-testing, yes.
It's huge. That's how I learn. And obviously then we go out to our communities and ask those questions. But understanding when you're going to sleep, what are things that are going to be triggering them? For example, perhaps having something that's going to be more balancing for your blood sugar before you go to sleep. A little bit of protein, a little bit of fat, rather than something that's high in refined carbohydrates, let's say, or has ultra processed sugars in it, or even alcohol. What's interesting to me about alcohol, and as we get into this phase of life, that before we may have wanted to have a nightcap, and especially over the last several years, like ending the night with a glass of wine or whatever it is, the problem as we go into this phase of life is alcohol can disrupt our sleep. We may fall asleep quicker, but we're going to get woken up when it metabolizes. And then for me, for example, I can't even drink alcohol anymore because it triggers a hot flash or a night sweat for me. So it's off the radar for me, and it affects our liver, and our liver's changing as we go into this phase of life. Our liver can either store fat or it can burn fat. It's a matter of what do we do? It's decisions that I find that we need to make as we go into this phase of life. Now, even chocolate, for example, if I have chocolate before bed, I will have night sweats. It's just the way my body processes it. Always listen to your body. Always understand what's good for you may not be good for me, and vice versa. When you listen to people speaking, of course, there's this overarching, here's what's recommended. And then there's you, what works best for your body. And even though kale might be a fabulous superfood, if it doesn't do well with you, then it's not good for your body. And I think that's an important thing for people to understand.
And the fact that it's changing. When somebody might be listening to this, I've noticed, and they say, but it used to, but Andrea, it used to. I used to be able to have a glass of wine. I used to be able to stay up late. I used to be able to have whatever before bed, and I would sleep. In fact, I would be asleep before my head hit the pillow. And I love that for them. Unfortunately, we do find, as you've said multiple times, that can change for a variety of reasons. Even if you're thinking, no, no, I can handle a glass of wine. Are you sure? Can you? Just check in with yourself. No, no, I can have chocolate before bed. I'm sure I can have whatever, coffee with cream before bed. I can have something high carb before bed. You might have in your 30s and your 20s. Are you sure you can with this transition? And I find that feedback from a lot of women, again, both practitioner and consumers, who were like, dang it.
Yeah.
That changed. I know. I know.
And that's why for me, it's very important. I always say, because our body's constantly changing, and I know when it comes to testing, and this is your area of expertise as well, it's really important that we stay on top of our health. And one of the things that I stress big time with our community is as you're transitioning through perimenopause into menopause, and then for the rest of your life, really, is getting the regular blood work, getting regular testing, looking at your thyroid, looking at your vitamin D levels, looking at your B12, your ferritin, your liver enzymes, all of these, your A1C, I can go on and on, your fasting glucose, your fasting insulin. These are important. And I understand there's always budgetary and insurance things that come into play. But if you can, at least once a year, have your thyroid checked, have these things checked, because it's changing and shifting all the time. I'll hear people say, my thyroid is fine. I checked it last year and it was totally fine. Well, maybe it's not anymore. Maybe in the last 6 months, it's changed. My thyroid changed in several different ways over the last couple of years. Stress can play a role. I just feel like as women who are going through this phase of life, I really want to empower women to take control of their health and their symptoms. And one of those major ways to do so is by getting regular blood work and seeing a healthcare practitioner that understands this phase of life and specializes in this phase of life.
And I think that's really key. Two of the things I want to go back to that you mentioned, just because I know it's a common topic. One is the muscle loss, the importance of lean muscle, and two are the GI changes. While itchy ears and phantom smells and some of the other less than optimal symptoms that are not well known, I don't think GI changes are known either, that the decline in estradiol and even progesterone shifts our microbiome. And that's not cool. That's just not cool.
As we go into this phase of life, you might notice that your gut is shifting and changing, like you said. Maybe before you can eat anything you want, and now you're finding, like you said, those same foods are actually causing gas, bloating, constipation, loose stools, indigestion. Perhaps food is just sitting in your belly. You're like, wait, it's been 4 hours since I had my steak meal. Why is it still in my stomach? Like, I feel like it has, nothing's moved. And then I want to go to bed. I don't want to eat too close to bed. How come these things are happening? Yeah, there's a lot that's going on. Stress levels, hormones, how we're absorbing our food, how we're breaking it down, all of that plays a role. And that's why it's really important. When we go into this phase of life, I say there's always two pillars that we need to really take charge of. There's our sleep and there's our digestion. And if you give that analogy, I used to say it's sleep number one, the star at the top of the Christmas tree, but really it's two. It's the sleep and it's the digestion that plays into everything else. Because when our gut is happy, our brain is happy. When our gut is upset, our brain is upset, and vice versa. And now we know that the gut is our second brain. What can we do to help it? Very important, nutrition. We really want to take a look at what we're eating, when we're eating. One of the things that really, when people are talking about what type of diets to eat, because I follow a lot of different creators and a lot of different experts and have a lot of different colleagues, and a lot of us have a lot of different opinions. And as somebody who has been in the nutrition world, in the health and wellness world for a really long time, now I'm going on to 24 years in the health and wellness world. I've been here a long time. And as a nutritionist for over 18 years, and constantly understanding myself and what I'm doing and trying different diets, I have learned that there is no one thing for everybody. Let's say, for example, you do really well with keto. Let's say, for example, somebody does really well with keto. Amazing. Maybe it's more of that short-term thing that you're doing. Maybe you can't do it long-term. Maybe you can. Maybe somebody else does really well with paleo. Depending what it is, or maybe somebody does great with a Mediterranean diet or a modified Mediterranean diet, right? So because we're all individual and unique, we all should do what works best for our body. And I think that's an important thing that we need to understand is into like, what are we eating? But what's the foundation, the pillars of how we should be eating? Of course, protein, lots of non-starchy vegetables, good quality fats, olive oil, avocado oil, coconut oil, ghee, grass-fed butter. These are things that we want to include and avoid things like seed oils, which is the work of Dr. Kate Shanahan. And we can go into that if you want, just to kind of give quickly what that is. And then you want to look at in lots of hydration, making sure you're hydrated, which can mess with our sleep and our blood sugar, by the way, when we're not hydrated, and our muscles. It helps to build muscles. Really important that we drink. Aim for half our weight in ounces, important. And then you also want to look at legumes, whole grains, as well as nuts and seeds, more in moderation. Again, if that works for you, maybe you can tolerate legumes, maybe you can't. But again, modifying it to what works for your genetic makeup.
Or if you happen to be the menopausal woman who has put on weight the weight you were or the weight you want to be, or how does that work?
I would say do it now. Do it for what you are now. Here's a really interesting story. As I mentioned, I've been doing this for a very long time, but I'm always learning. I'm always kind of like, tell me what's in the research. Let me learn something new. When I had put on this weight after losing and then putting back that and then some, is I was like, okay, why am I not able to take it off? Now, of course, hormones come into play. There's leptin, adiponectin, all of these things, which we can talk about when it comes to genetics and just different things, the way they present. But also, maybe there's a way in what I was eating that I wasn't really paying attention to. This is something that happened to me recently that I want to share, because it's always like, okay, wow, that's really interesting. That worked. I know for my body, genetically, I've had genetic testing done, that I don't do great with carbs, with too many carbs. I don't do great either with too much fat, too much saturated fat. If I have more than 28 grams of saturated fat, I'm producing a lot of ghrelin, which is the hunger hormone. I have to have this delicate balance, but I don't really, and because of diet culture and because of my sensitivity, and because I don't want to go back to where I was back then, having to worry about every little thing, I've come to a place of like, I like being where I am, but I also want to make sure that I'm maintaining a healthy weight. And I started paying attention a little bit more to the carbohydrates that I was eating. And for the longest time, I didn't. And in the last couple of weeks, I started paying attention. Okay, I'm trying to eat lower carbs, whole grains when I'm eating it. I'm still eating carbohydrates. We need our carbohydrates, but I'm just eating a little bit less of it, paying attention a little bit more to what I'm eating. And what I found was that made a very big difference for me. If you look at someone like my husband, he's not in menopause, he's a man, but if you look at him, he can eat it no problem and it doesn't affect him in any way, shape, or form. Again, it goes back to how does it help you and your body? I would say for women in menopause and perimenopause, for the most part, really focusing on that protein, using that formula that I gave you, eating lots of non-starchy vegetables, eating those good quality oils that help to reduce that inflammation, and then focusing on the fiber is a very big one too, 25 to 35 grams of fiber a day. Please, ladies, you want to get your fiber. I know you talk about that a lot for hormones and metabolites, like waste, bacteria, for it to all come out. And then looking at your hydration and then looking at your whole grains, your legumes and your nuts and seeds. And I'd say that's probably a good formula that you could follow and then tweak it from there. If you want to lose weight, maybe you want to look at something like going a little bit lower carbohydrate, not super low, but maybe a little bit lower, but maybe super low for your body, or intermittent fasting. There's different things that you can adapt and customize based on your body type.
Going back to the fiber, do you have favorite ways of getting fiber in the body? I am seeing a lot of research on that, on that there, obviously there are different kinds of fiber and what they do in the body, what they do for the microbiome in our gut. I know somebody's going to say, well, there's so many options. Which one do I do?
Yeah, we want to get fruits and vegetables, your non-starchy vegetables, your fruits, your lower glycemic fruits. Berries are amazing, great, have a lot of fiber. You want to look at your maybe a sour apple, something that's a little bit lower, maybe on that glycemic index, if you're more sensitive to it. And then I would say your legumes, your nuts and seeds, your whole grains, all of those are amazing forms of fiber. And prebiotics. Because prebiotics feed the good bacteria in our gut, and prebiotics are also a form of fiber. What are those? Garlic, onion, asparagus, Jerusalem artichokes, jicama, carrots with the peels on. I learned that from you. There's different things that we could be eating that actually feed that good bacteria. And then if you need extra fiber, then there's great soluble fibers out there. Like we have one called FiberS, which is why we launched it, because we want to make sure. I always say, you know me, Carrie, I like my little props. We always want to make sure we are pooping every single day. If you need that extra help, which most of us are only getting about 50% of the required fiber a day. If you can get extra fiber, you need that little bit of help, then you've got some soluble fiber like a FiberS that works great. And it gives you that little bit of extra fiber you might need in your diet.
And I think that is so helpful. And let's go to hydration. You had mentioned half your body weight in ounces. So I just want to come back to that because I know it's a very common question. Does coffee count? Does tea count? Does juice count? And then what if it's filtered? Do I need to add electrolytes? How does it go with hydration?
Everything counts towards our daily intake of fluids. You want to get your primary, if you can, obviously from water. Not everybody likes to drink water. That's why I always say, well, maybe you want to add something to it. You can infuse it with fruit. Again, always wanting to see how this affects your blood sugar, of course. You can add in a little bit of lemon, being mindful of your teeth. There's like all these things to keep in mind. But if you want to add something to your water, chlorophyll, I really like a drop or two of chlorophyll, makes it taste great. And I'm loving electrolytes these days. I have to tell you, and from the research that I was doing, and I do intermittent fasting, I know it's not for everybody, but it works really great for my body. So when I'm intermittent fasting, I've been drinking this electrolyte that I put in my water. It tastes amazing. And I know that it doesn't have an effect on my blood sugar or my insulin. For me, it's working really great. Yes, I do believe we need electrolytes. We are so depleted of minerals as we go into this place. We know the World Health Organization has told us, they've been very vocal about the fact that we don't have enough minerals in our soil. I do believe, and that's why as a nutritionist, our number one focus, and for me, is always food, food, nutrition, nutrition, food. That has to be the foundation for everything. Lifestyle, also important. And then supplement when you need to supplement. That's why it's called a supplement. However we can get our nutrition, our nutrients, that to me, our minerals, is really important. Because when we're mineral depleted, that could affect our blood sugar. That can affect a lot of different parts of us. Our nutrition, to me, I'm a big fan of electrolytes, to answer your question. But then you can also get your fluids from soups, from vegetable soups. You can get it from vegetables. I did a TV segment many years ago, and it was showing all the different vegetables. When you have spinach, you have tons of spinach. And then when you actually cook it down, it was like this little tablespoon of it, right? It was funny. Yes. But fruits have a lot of water also. So you can get it from other sources as well. You just want to be mindful of caffeinated sources. I would say that would be something. If you want herbal teas, maybe you can drink herbal tea all day long without putting any sugar or any sweetener in it. Just again, keeping mindful of other things. But I would say herbal teas are another great way to get your fluids in as well.
And then let's talk about intermittent fasting, because I know there's a lot of debate out there. Dr. Mindy Pels and Cynthia Thurlow are good friends of mine. And they've worked a lot with, of course, intermittent fasting and hormones, whether you're cycling, perimenopausal, or menopausal. I know even in the community, if you are cycling, following your menstrual cycle. If you are brand new to intermittent fasting, no idea what I'm talking about, don't just jump into fasting. Get a resource. Get either Dr. Mindy's book or Cynthia's book. But talk to us about your view on intermittent fasting when it comes to this transition.
I love the fact that you mentioned Cynthia and Mindy. Both of them are complete experts when it comes to this phase of life. I've interviewed both of them and they're both amazing. And I love that you gave them a shout out. So it's great. So my point of view is I am a big fan of intermittent fasting. And I feel that for my body, again, my genetic makeup, it works really well for me. I did it all the way through perimenopause and now I do it into menopause. And the longer I do it, I find the better and the more metabolically flexible I get. And there's a lot of controversy around it. I know there's a lot of people that don't believe in it. And that's okay because it's not for everybody. And everybody, again, does what's good for them. But from the research I read, I interviewed Dr. Jason Fung as well. And from all the research and the people that I've spoken to, it really does show some promising results, not only for maintaining weight or perhaps even losing weight for some people, but also for brain health, for cleaning up things in our body. There's so much good research around it. If you're asking me for my opinion, I think it's great. I do think that when I've spoken to some friends of mine who have said, oh, I tried it, it didn't work for me, I do think there's some nuances with it. That's why I love the idea you suggested, Mindy's book, Fast Like a Girl, and Cynthia's book. They'll explain it in much more detail than we're talking about it right now, but there are nuances around it that maybe, I know Cynthia believes very much in clean fasting, and I know, but there's some other people that say, well, maybe you don't have to do it as to the T. Maybe there's some other ways that you could do it that can still be beneficial. Volta Longo, I know that the fasting mimicking diet is another option. I think that if it's something that you're interested in and you want to learn more about it, those were all great people that we mentioned that you could look into that can provide you with a lot more information and research behind it, which is important.
For sure. For me, I have done, just from my own experience, I have done Walter Longo's fasting mimicking diet 3 times. For those listening, that's the ProLon diet. It's the ProLon kit. And with intermittent fasting, I found I am much better when I am done eating earlier. So a lot of the biohackers, mostly male, not always, skip breakfast and start their first meal way later in the day. And then they end at 7 or 8 at night, or it kind of depends. And that's how they get their 6, 7, or 8 hours of their eating window in. And we should clarify, intermittent fasting, sometimes people interpret that as, oh, you're just skipping a meal. Of course, you're going to lose weight. If your normal calorie is 2,200 calories a day, you just get it in a short, you just get it in 8 hours as opposed to grazing from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. when you go to bed. So it's just a condensed window of all your calories. Now, of course, you can lower your calories, but that's not the purpose behind intermittent fasting. I found for me in particular, if I do intermittent fasting, I do better to do especially high protein earlier, closer to waking, and then be done sooner, which doesn't always make it easy for travel or for events or for dinners. You just adapt and modify. But I have found I work better that way. But I hear a lot of men go the opposite way. They skip breakfast, start at lunch, and go the rest of their day. And I think it really depends on the woman.
Mm-hmm. On each of our,
try a few ways. Yeah. And then I't do it when I'm about a week in the luteal phase. I don't do it very much leading up to my period because then I know I'm grumpier and that's not a nice person to be around.
And you brought up a really good point, Carrie. You're talking about making sure you're eating enough, because that's another reason, and it could be a reason why we're not losing weight perhaps the way we want to, is because when we don't eat enough, many women have told me, I don't understand why I'm not losing weight. I'm not even eating a lot. And that could be an issue too, where you want to eat more. You have to get enough of your daily nutrients, your daily calories in, because when you don't, what happens is your body thinks that it's in starvation mode and then it doesn't allow the weight to come off. That's one of the reasons. But you want to make sure you're eating enough. And I think that's key, because a lot of women are told, eat less, exercise more. No, that doesn't work anymore as we get into this phase of life. Really understanding how much your body needs to actually work properly and function properly is really important. Eating enough, drinking enough, both are super key when it comes to that.
What about hunger? You mentioned earlier for you when you noticed you keep your protein or saturated fat, carbs, et cetera, it doesn't affect your ghrelin hormone, which ghrelin is your like GRM, hungry hormone. And I have seen a symptom in perimenopause and menopause is, oh my gosh, my appetite is voracious. Make it stop. How do you help that?
Here's the thing about ghrelin. I did a TikTok about it because when I was doing my deep dive into research, one of the symptoms I had in perimenopause was I had this insatiable appetite. Nothing I could eat can actually satisfy my appetite. And I'm like, why is it? Okay, yep, genetics come into play. I mentioned that earlier. But what I found was is that in perimenopause, we actually have higher levels of ghrelin than we do in menopause and than we do in before perimenopause and premenopause. So I was like, oh, that makes sense. So if you're experiencing a crazy amount, your hunger is just out of control, then that's another symptom of perimenopause and menopause. Really making sure that you're getting enough protein and fat, and then also exercise can really help with that.
And fiber. I found that the fiber has been made a big difference as well. Protein for sure.
Fiber is good for like everything. Fiber is like this.
Fiber and sleep.
It's like, what's the solution? Fiber. And then a magnesium. What's the solution? Fiber, magnesium, sleep. There you go.
Actually, going back to sleep and that white paper that you published in part of that paper, and remind me, did people have suggestions or did you offer solutions of here are the most common things we see that can be corrective and helpful in this transition when they're struggling with that 2 to 4 a.m. sleep?
Specifically for the 2 to 4 a.m. sleep, obviously managing stress before you go into bed, doing some type of deep breathing, meditation, perhaps taking a warm bath with a little bit of essential oils. You can put essential oils on your hands. You can do these amazing meditations. I love, there's this woman, she does a lot of somatic therapy too, which again, could be another reason. I actually identified 15 different reasons, but they all overlap with each other as to why we're gaining weight directly or indirectly in this phase of life. And this woman, her name is Sandra Rolis. She has this somatic therapy that she's on YouTube, amazing meditation. You can listen to that before bed. Anything that's just going to help you to relax before you go to sleep is really key. Sleep hygiene, sleep routines, going to bed at the same time is really important. But specifically for that stress or that cortisol, it's really managing stress. That really is what it comes down to in terms of, and also avoiding things that we know that take the joy out of life. How do we lower cortisol levels? Making sure we find joy, making sure we find happiness, making sure that we spend time with people we love, and maybe avoiding people that are creating some issues for us. Maybe turning off the news, maybe not going on social media or watching the news before bed, because that can create a lot of stress as well for us. I notice when during the day I'm super busy and then right before bed, I'm like, okay, let me start. Let me see what's going on. And then I'm like, uh-oh, this is going to affect my sleep. I really have to be conscious of it. Turning off, maybe not being exposed to blue light before bed, that's going to have an effect. There's so many different things that we want to take into consideration that will help us get that better night's sleep. Obviously, supplements is a big part of what I do. I love there's certain supplements that help as well. And then you also want to make sure that your room is dark. You want to make sure that your room is not noisy. You want to make sure your room is cool. 65 to 68 degrees. If your room is hot, it will wake you up in the middle of the night. Making sure you're sleeping in like light PJs, making sure that maybe your cover's not too heavy. And maybe some women have said they sleep with their window open a lot, or fans next to their bed, or ice packs on their bed. Again, these are all things that come into play when it comes to sleep in general, but specifically for stress and that 2 to 4 a.m. wake-up call, I'd say that it really is managing those cortisol levels and stress is important.
Absolutely. And I just want to say that it has just been such an honor to have you on, because we talk a lot about hormones. We talk a lot about hormone replacement therapy just on social media or in general, and have on this podcast. And while I'm a huge fan of hormone replacement therapy or menopausal therapy for the right woman, I feel like sometimes these extra super important foundational things we can do and can be very proactive about don't get discussed as much. It's estrogen, progesterone, or nothing. And they're very helpful, absolutely. However, so is your diet. So is your sleep. If one of your main pillars is sleep and you're not sleeping, sure, the hormones can absolutely help. But if you are high stress, high sugar, and swollen with a glass of wine before you go to bed, the estradiol is not going to help that. If you're low fiber, not getting enough protein, not moving enough, all the things that you were really just talking about, I love that the whole approach is very proactive. And I just want to thank you for that, because a lot of women feel stuck and a lot of women feel their practitioners not listening to them. And there aren't a lot of great resources out there.
Oh, thank you. I always say my lane is nutrition, lifestyle, supplements, and research. That I do all day long, all the time. Hormones is out of my lane. And that's why I love interviewing people like yourself. You are the hormone experts. We come together. To me, everything is synergistic. Everything works together beautifully. We have our toolbox. And in our toolbox, we can have one, the other, everything all together. And when you're doing it all together, it just works that much better.
Absolutely. Well, speaking of resources, where can people find you? Tell us all the places.
I live on TikTok. You can find me at Andrea Donsky on TikTok. That's where I like to be silly and educational. And we have our website, which is wearemorphous.com. Morphous is metamorphosis. Morph us is a community. That's the name of our company. We picked this word. It's wearemorphous.com. And then obviously on Instagram at wearemorphous. And we pretty much are on every social media platform. It's either at Andrea Donsky or at wearemorphous.
And the white papers that we talked about today about the symptoms of menopause and sleep are available on wearemorphous.com.
They are. Right now we have our signs and symptoms white paper that's there. I believe our sleep white paper is going up. If it's not already, it should be up shortly. And then we will have three more white papers that we're going to be publishing soon. We have another survey that we have on mood and anxiety. And then we have another one on phantom smells, which is very popular. Again, a lot of people like, what are we smelling in this phase of life? And we have one on women in the workplace. We will have more coming up. But I would love for those of you who are listening, if you go to our website under research, if you could fill out our surveys, because to me, that's what fuels us. We love to understand what's happening to all of you as you're going through this phase of life. To me, I would be super grateful.
Amazing. Once again, Andrea, thank you so much for coming on the Root Cause Medicine podcast.
Thanks for having me, Carrie. This is really fun.
Oh my goodness. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode.
We have one quick favor to ask you before you go.
If you love today's conversation, would you mind leaving us a 5-star review on whatever podcast platform you're listening on right now?
Our whole goal is education. So positive reviews are actually the number one thing that help new people discover the show.
You're amazing, and we appreciate it so much.
We'll catch you next time on the Root Cause Medicine podcast.